You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, there's a secret side of Wisconsin, a whole smorgasbord of places to see, stuff to do, things to eat and experience that maybe, even if you've been living here or visiting for a really long time, you just haven't come across or heard of before. Our next guest shares some of those unique discoveries in their new book, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is a well-kept secret in your neck of the woods? Maybe a business that the locals know about, a restaurant, cultural location, place where something weird happened once. Is there something you take out-of-towners to all the time? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tom Manis and Christy Flick Manis are freelance travel writers based in Eau Claire. They run the website smalltownplussize.com. Their new book is called Secret Wisconsin, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. Christy and Tom, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio.
Thanks for having us.
Now, you're travel writers. You do stuff around the world. But in your own backyard here in Wisconsin, you like to seek out cool and wonderful stuff. Christy, let's start with you. Could you talk about the philosophy, the kind of things you're trying to find?
We just look for stuff you don't find on Google search. We like to get out. We don't like to warm a couch. We like to be on the go all the time. And we're always just looking for unique things.
And Tom, it occurs to me reading your book that, you know, a lot of times when I travel, yeah, I'll do the big tourist site that you got to go. The things I remember are the little stuff that I hadn't heard of before I got there. Is that what you find in Wisconsin and around the world?
Oh, exactly. Usually what we found is that the things we look forward to, we often get disappointed with. But it's those things that we unexpectedly find on back roads, two-lane highways, no matter where we're at in the world, that we talk about forever, and those make the best memories.
What is your secret, Christy, to finding these things? Because the key here is there's stuff that not everybody knows about. They don't come out upon that web search.
I think just talking to locals, just finding things that are unique that nobody really knows about.
Tom, how do you strike up that conversation?
You just ask.
Well, do you say, hey, I'm a travel writer, and, or you just like, you're at a restaurant and you just start talking?
Oh, we just start talking. I mean, we'll, you know, start talking to someone and say, hey, what's there something unique, something fun to do that maybe not everybody knows about in your area?
And listen to people. Go to the local grocery store and just listen to what people are talking about. That we're famous for that all over the world. We always hit the local grocery store and just chit chat with people.
Now, with the book now, Secret Wisconsin, Christy, was the problem, okay, how are we going to find enough stuff to fill the book? Or was the problem, we've got so much stuff we could get into the book, how do we narrow it down?
It was hard to narrow down. We had way more than we could have ever used, and we had to narrow it down to 84 items. And that was really hard. So already we're thinking, oh, we're going to have to make another one.
A sequel?
Yes.
Excellent. Why 84? That's a pretty specific number.
That is what our publisher gave us.
That seems random. Okay, but cool.
It is random.
It is.
We are talking about the new book, Secret Wisconsin, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. Tom Manis, Christy Flick Manis are here with me. They're the authors. Do you have this in your part of the state, that cool local thing? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Flip it around. When you are a traveler, do you look for these things off the beaten path? Do you talk to local people about what you should see, whether you're traveling in Wisconsin or on the other side of the planet? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us what you found. I want to give a listen. There's a little bit of overlap between your book and our show. We are kindred spirits, I guess. Mm-hmm. What the first thing in your book actually is this sign on top of a house by Mitchell Airport there in Milwaukee. The sign says, and you can see this from a plane sometimes, welcome to Cleveland. I talked to Mark Gubin about why he did this. Here's a listen.
Oh, it was 1978, and I was up there, I think it was a Wednesday, and my secretary and I were having lunch up there, and we watched these planes come over, and I'm on the final approach for runway 19 for Mitchell Field, and their flaps were 45 degrees and the wheels were down, and it was sounded like the end of the world. And I thought, well, they can all see us here in the roof too. And my secretary said we should put a big welcome sign, welcome to Milwaukee. And I thought, well, no, why don't we put something else there, like welcome to Cleveland, because it's a hard world out there. People need to smile a little bit.
That was your lead story in the book. Tom, tell us a little more about the welcome to Cleveland sign, again, in Milwaukee.
Well, first of all, we love quirky. And so we thought this would be the first one that would really set the tone for the book. Our son is a licensed drone pilot. He does work for NASA projects and so forth in different countries around the world and also in the U.S. So the best way to get that picture was to send him, we took him with us and to send him up with this drone. But that is one item that when we knew immediately that had to go in the book.
That's only in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
That you would see something like that. But now it's in Australia, too.
Oh, somebody's going to copy it in Perth or something like that. Yeah. Now, here's one that I hadn't heard of. I've heard of House on the Rock, right? That's too famous to be in your book. I had not heard of Rock in the House. I got to say, Rock in the House, I laughed out loud as I was reading this one. Tell us a little bit about that one, Christy.
Well, it's a house where a rock, a gigantic rock, has rolled into it. The people were living there at the time, and the people moved out and just left it. And everything is still in the house. You can walk into the house. There's a little parking lot there. It's open to the public. There's nobody there. And it's definitely worth a stop.
And this is by Fountain City, was it?
It is. It's in Fountain City.
Now, everybody be careful if you do check it out. This is, you mentioned earlier, Christy, there are, animals can get in and
out. There are all kinds of animals living in it. The medicine is still in the medicine cabinet. The bed is still made. Everything is identical. Nobody has touched anything.
And I'm thinking, and you mentioned this in the book, I'd be looking at where that rock came from to see if another one's going to follow it down.
Yes. Yes.
Let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Heather is with us in River Falls. Heather, hello.
Good afternoon. Hi. My husband and I traveled Turkey this spring. And we went to a place on the Mediterranean, the Glitter Hotel we were staying at. By the way, Turkey is extremely underrated. Go, 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 go. You mentioned this little town during the war with Greece. The entire population picked up and moved over to the Greek side. We were trying to find that. Ended up on this little teeny tiny road down to a cove where there was this island with ruins on it. And we're like, well, that's really cool. So a couple of guys in a shack smoking hookah. We asked them about the island. They said, oh, well, we'll take you out there for 500 lira, which was like $20. Let's go.
Heather, I got you. Thanks for the call. Not great connection there, but Heather and her husband went on a back road, met some people, discovered some cool stuff that they hadn't expected. Is that something you do? Oh, it sounds like that's something you'd certainly do, Tom, when you travel.
Oh, absolutely. That's how you do it. You just get out and go. When we travel, we don't have a plan. We have no agenda. Whatever direction we feel like going at the moment, that's where we go. And that's how you find things. You just take the small roads. And you, with the question of, I wonder what's back here.
We don't even really Google or look anything up before we go. We just go. And we do that wherever we are in the world. If we're going to Europe, we will just rent a car with no plan and just get our car and just take off.
Now, my worry would be, I've spent all this money to get to this place, or I only have X number of days or whatever, and maybe with my sense of adventure, I end up at a shopping mall. That's not very exciting. Are you just really lucky, or do you have a sense for how to find the cool stuff?
The first thing we do is get out of the city and head to the country.
You'll find it. there are days where you're just in beautiful scenery, beautiful, country, just with landscapes. And, there are times when you just come across things that are not planned, and, this is the highlight of the day and could be the highlight of the trip.
We're talking to Eau Claire-based travel writers Christy Flick-Manis and Tom Manis about their new book. It's called Secret Wisconsin, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests about how to find cool stuff wherever you travel? Do you do what they do when you go someplace new, either here in the state or around the world? Do you try to find those things? Do you talk to the locals and see what they recommend you do? Do you want to highlight something in your neighborhood, in your community here in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with travel writers Tom Manis and Christy Flick Manis from Eau Claire. Their new book is called Secret Wisconsin, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite local site, someplace you take people to from out of town that nobody else knows about, 800-642-1234. I want to give a listen now. Again, we talked to somebody you highlight in the book. This is Ron Berger from the Corral Bar and Riverside Grill in Durand. Now, he was doing some renovation work and found this huge 1885 circus advertisement. Here's a listen to Ron.
Where I cut in is a perfectly located buffalo piece charging at me when I opened up the lath and plaster, complete with snort coming out the nostrils. So it's kind of an interesting type of thing. But, you know, that wasn't so surprising. I think, you know, because the first take was, it was just a green kind of a paper that I seen the first place where I ended up cutting a buffalo's tail off. But it ended up being a grassy plain behind the buffalo. But it was the same color, so there wasn't no artwork on that right there when I initially pulled. But once I started pulling plaster off and lath, there, you know, it revealed a Native American riding behind the buffalo, and then the buffalo horn, the head, and all that stuff. And then on the bottom, Russell and Morgan Printing Company, Cincinnati, Ohio, on the bottom.
This one got some attention. How did you two find out, Tom, about this mural?
It's only about 20 minutes from us, and I don't remember how we found out about it, but we had to see it.
Yeah.
Because it was a temporary poster that the circus workers would put up, and it was only supposed to last for 2 months. And it's 55 feet long by 9 feet tall. So how in the world did this temporary circus poster last for over 100 years? So we had to see it. And it was originally... when they put it on the wall, it's a lithograph, but when they put it on the wall, it faced the river, so the boats coming down could see it.
Oh, yeah. Cool. That's a great story. I love that one. Let's go back to our callers now. Lanny is with us in Ashland. Lanny, hello.
Hello, hello. How are you?
Good. You have a cool thing to share with us.
I got a couple cool things. I live in northern Wisconsin, way up here by Lake Superior, and there's a community called Ulu. O-U-L-U-O, and it's a Finnish community, but actually a bunch of hippies kind of moved in there. They all have farms in there, but the rock is out there on Highway 2, and it's about as big as a car, and people paint it all the time, and people always ask, say, what's Ulu? You know what I mean? It's pretty cool, you know? So a lot of people in Ulu, they say, well, you know, people in Ulu are smarter than the people in New York. They say, why is that? And they say, well, people in Ulu know what New York is, but the people in New York don't know what Ulu is. No.
Lanny, thanks a lot for the call. You two were nodding along as he was talking about Ulu, Christy.
Yeah, we're real familiar with Ulu, and there's a glass blowing place there that we enjoy going to.
Interesting.
And also we have some pottery and soup mugs from Barb's Jugs. I don't know if she's still in business. That was years ago. But Ulu is a cool community.
Lanny, thanks a lot for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Okay, now within my first few days of moving to Wisconsin, this is back in the early 90s, I encountered the annual cow chip throw in the Sauk City, Prairie du Sac area. This one, though, I hadn't heard about the annual cabbage chuck in Shiocton.
I hadn't heard of that either, and it just caught my eye. I heard about it and thought, well, right away I thought coleslaw. And fish fries. Coleslaw goes with fish fries, so truly it's something Wisconsin.
Sure.
And it's a festival they have every year, and they chuck cabbage.
Now, I've been to the cow chip throw, I have not signed up to throw. Did either of you try throwing the cabbage, though?
We didn't.
No.
We didn't. We are not chuckers.
I will say, cow chips, it's amazing how far people could throw them. What kind of distances were you seeing? Was it pretty impressive with the cabbage?
Some people were impressive. And I think that happened again, was it last weekend or this weekend was the festival?
Oh, no kidding. I didn't check the dates. Yeah.
And that's also, they make sauerkraut in that town.
Right.
They're one of the biggest producers of sauerkraut.
Oh, that makes sense with the cabbage then. Now, here's one. I've never been to Don's TV and Repair Shop. There's some secrets behind this one.
That's fairly new.
Okay.
I'm thinking maybe 2 years.
Seems about 2 years, right? And when you go in, well, first of all, on the outside it is really cool because who repairs TVs anymore? But he has the old signs out front and then the newspaper covering the windows, you know, of Don's TV Repair. But when you go in the door, there is just a little room, and it has a counter and an old 7-Up glass bottle soda machine. And so you have to hit it right to get the right words so they'll let you in. But once you're in, though, it's all 80s.
It's, you know, I grew up in the 80s. Mm-hmm. I graduated in 85. So to me, this was the greatest thing ever to go back and see all the things from that era in a little restaurant that nobody knew about.
Right. So that's the secret. This is in Milwaukee, I should mention.
Yes.
It functions like an old-fashioned Prohibition era speakeasy, right? But with a 1980s design?
Yes. Yes.
It's dark inside, and they have TVs going, and you have, you know, the old telephones and shows.
They're playing VHS tapes from the 80s on VCRs. It's such a throwback. It's a great place to take kids.
But you have to know the secret code phrase.
You do.
What do I ask for? Oh, I pulled it up in your book here. I have to ask for...
Ice cold 7-Up.
Ice cold 7-Up.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's just... And I shouldn't bring my broke TV there, right?
No.
Well, it'd be fun.
Yeah.
Let's go back to our callers. Margaret is with us in Minneapolis. Margaret, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to tell you that a couple of years ago, I flew into Milwaukee to visit some friends. And on the other side of the TSA check-in area in the Milwaukee airport is a big sign that says recombobulation area. Because you have been discombobulated by TSA, and now you get recombobulated.
I love that. And I think they sell T-shirts and stuff now for the recombobulation area. There's a blog and stuff, too, if I'm not mistaken. I love that because I've never seen that in another airport. That is another weirdly unique Wisconsin thing.
Mm-hmm. It is, definitely.
Thanks a lot for sharing that one, Margaret. We are talking to Tom and Christy Flick-Manis. Their new book is Secret Wisconsin, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. Well, I've got a big list. You've got a huge list in the book. I'll ask each of you to just throw me a cool one that you might recommend people check out. Let's start with you, Christy.
Friday morning fish fry.
Friday morning?
In the morning.
Fish fry.
Starting at 8 a.m. You can get your fish fry.
Where is
that? And that's in Kenosha at a bakery, Oliver's Bakery. And they've been doing this for...
Well over 40 years. The current owner has owned it for 40 years, and she has no idea when the tradition started,
really?
But she just carried it on.
And people line up Friday morning to get their fish fry.
Fish and shrimp.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get the fish and shrimp breakfast?
We did.
It was really good.
It's okay. Only fish and shrimp. They don't have the sides. But
but it's a bakery.
It's amazing. Yes.
It's so
it's
I could get donuts with my fish.
You could get a Persian and a fish.
Even that a Kringle. It's an old-fashioned bakery that are going, you know, the kind that are going away. And she actually makes her own buttercream homemade there. It's a good bakery.
That sounds fantastic. Okay, now, Tom, you can volunteer one here. I know it's hard to choose from all 84.
There are so many. I would say maybe Croca Curl in Altoona. And everybody says, Croca what?
Yeah.
So it's a cross between...
Oh, yeah. I saw this in the book. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a cross between curling and the Canadian board game, Crokinole. So you have a sheet of ice that's about, I believe it's around 45 feet in circumference, and you have metal poles around the middle hole that you slide small curling stones into, you know, different rings for different scores, and then if you make it into the bucket, then it's 20 points. So the Altoona Parks and Recreation, they wanted something to do during COVID to get people outside and get active. And so they found this online on a Canadian, Facebook chat or Facebook group, and they implemented it. And it's a lot of fun. But I would say that, I mean, there's so many, we could go forever.
Yeah, the circular curling, basically, instead of on a track.
Right, yeah. Right. It's a small circumference, right.
All right, now, just a minute or so left, what are your next travel plans?
Well, we're going to Iowa next week.
Okay.
See, I don't sound... Now,
some people might say, oh, Iowa, that's not exciting, but you're going to find something cool, I imagine.
We probably will.
We just got back from Indiana about a week and a half ago.
Did you find anything cool there? I drive often through that little northwest corner to get to Michigan. I don't stop in Indiana much. What should I find there?
We actually did find some unique things. There's a place that raises pigs, and their pigs have apartments.
Okay.
They have couches and TVs and...
Toys.
Yes. Pig toys. It was a little strange, but... They really had apartments.
And the reason is because pigs have feelings.
That's the motto there?
Kind of, I believe.
Well, it was a sanctuary, and the pigs were adopted by people when there was that period when people wanted to have pigs as pets.
Yeah.
And so they were used to living in homes. So the sanctuary had to make homes for the pigs.
Awesome. Well, that's a great example of the kind of thing we could find. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Been talking to Christy Flick-Manis and Tom Manis from Eau Claire. They are travel writers. Their new book is called Secret Wisconsin, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. You can follow their website, smalltownplussize.com. They're speaking at Rock Garden Tavern in Phillips on Saturday, October 28th. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at public opinion of the U.S. military, why it's stayed high in recent years. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, news sites are seeing a major decline in web traffic referrals from social media. We'll find out what that means for news outlets and the ways we get our news online and on our phones. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. How do you get your news, and especially online? How do you keep up? If you're like a lot of people, that answer has changed over the years. For a long time, social media platforms, including Facebook and Twitter, now called X, played a huge role in linking people to news stories. But new data from the website analytics company SimilarWeb shows that top online news sites are seeing drastic decreases in web traffic coming from those social media platforms. In just the last 2.5 years, web traffic referrals from Facebook and Twitter dropped over 75%. That's just the latest shakeup for news outlets trying to attract and retain audiences and keep revenue coming in. Less web traffic has meant more layoffs and closures in the news industry as outlets try to adapt. It also leaves the news consumer to navigate where to get news and how to vet it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How much have you used social media for news? Has that changed over the years? Do you have, when your online news sites that you go to or aggregator apps or sites that you use to keep up with the news? Let us know. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Patrick Johnson is an assistant professor of journalism and director of student media at Marquette University. Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, great to be here.
The numbers sound pretty stark. How big a deal is this decline in social media links to news sites?
Well, let's just say it's another one of those wonderful hiccups in journalism's evolution to the digital world. I think what we see is such a significant rise in mis and disinformation in social media spaces that it's forced people to really reckon with what does social media do for them and how exactly has social media created a news ecosystem that's worth trusting. And I think that's a really important question that news consumers need to be asking themselves. To what extent did Facebook content really give them the the correct news, and it, to what extent has now X, after being musked, what is it now doing to promote pro-social media content? I mean, we've seen headlines being taken away in the most recent update of X. And so news organizations are really going to have to figure out what does this mean when for several years they've used social media as a main driver to their websites.
To what extent, when that peak period was there, when social media was a key source of links to news websites, were news outlets writing in some ways for social media to optimize their content so that they would show up on the Facebooks and Twitter and other platforms to get people there in the first place?
100%. And it is laughable. Like, I mean, we saw in the advent of the internet, which when I talk to students about that, they're like, wait, the internet didn't exist. You know, there was these substantial panics around how digital first models were going to impact advertising. Mm-hmm. Well, then we had social media, in which all of a sudden we had another panic of, okay, so how do we get people to our websites using this like miraculous software that is social? And what happened was we saw different ways in which journalism responded. We saw people writing SEO headlines. We saw clickbait style headlines and images and graphics. We started to see almost this interesting return to like yellow journalism kind of practices. And it's kind of gotten away from us. I would say social media has become such a beast, especially in the news industry, that we are definitely in a place where we have to say, what did we do? It's Frankensteinian, so to speak. We've got this monster that we as Frankenstein have created. And now we're trying to say, okay, now what do we do? Like, how do we take this back? Well, it's there. And now, unfortunately, journalism is facing the consequences of not investing in other models and ways. I think there are organizations that are doing this, that are helping to combat some of this reliance on social media. But unless we're willing to buy into some of these organizations who are really doing their due diligence to bring trust back in the news, we're really gonna have to like fight to figure out what is attraction to news sites look like now that social media is such a hellscape.
And at a fundamental level, I mean, over the years, we've seen a lot of smaller communities flat out lose their local newspapers if they had one in the first place. We've seen cutbacks at a lot of the big chains, even some of the biggest names in news. We see headlines about layoffs, the newest one, Washington Post, some voluntary buyouts on the way. At all levels, it seems like, Patrick, a lot of media outlets that people used to rely on are struggling. How bad are things?
How sad do you want me to go with this? You know, I'm a blissful optimist. And the reason I say that is we do also have problems that we need to address. And I think, for example, hedge funds are buying up our newspapers left and right, and they're buying up our television stations, and they're creating significant layoffs in the process. Social media also contributed to those layoffs because we didn't need as many people because, quote unquote, anybody could have been a journalist, which I don't believe or agree with. We also are dealing with the AI revolution, and we're seeing this in the writer's strike, and we are seeing this in the actor's strike. I think journalists also need to push back in their labor unions on the use of AI. We also are seeing news deserts, meaning all of these local publications that are going under because people don't have the money to pay for the journalism in their communities. And so, yeah, that's sad. That's horrible. I believe news is one of the foundational pieces to how we live and breathe in a functional democratic society. The optimist in me says, we always find a way. And again, there are certain organizations like Trusting News, for example, and to be transparent, I do research work for them. So it's not that I'm not just using them for that purpose, where they're looking to get into newsrooms and they're looking to do training and development opportunities, especially down at the level of local press, to get people to come back to the news and to find ways for community members to find trust in the news, to subscribe again, to be able to get returning customers. The thing that we're seeing the most right now across the country is this pushback on what journalism stands for. And so it's not even just the economic, it's not even just trust. It's this heightened sense of political concern, in that conservative readers, for the most part around the country, are retreating from the news. We're finding that they don't appreciate certain elements of diversity in publications, and that journalism is seen as a liberal cause. On the flip side, we're seeing people from marginalized communities, like Black and Brown communities, the LGBTQ community, who are also pushing back on journalism for not telling their stories appropriately, and for creating a historical harm. And so, because we have all of these things pushing back on us as an industry, it's going to push us into a corner. And sometimes the best way to find a solution is to move from the corner. Now, if I had the answer, I would have a lot of money. but I do think we can get there. I do think that there's ways in which we can work collectively, both as, I think, as academics and as news professionals, specifically in our classroom spaces. I think right now the answer is in one of our classrooms. And we have to tap that. We have to find that.
We're talking to Marquette University journalism professor Patrick Johnson about a decline in social media links to news outlets and what it means for news organizations and the ways we consume news. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Want to hear about the practicalities of when you are on a computer or your phone or your tablet or whatever. How do you seek out news? Do you click through on social media links of one sort or another? Do you open an Apple News or Google News app or website and find links to lots of outlets? Or do you go to the Metropolis Times or whatever news outlet you go to, maybe a non-fictional one, for example? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Patrick Johnson, Assistant Professor of Journalism, Director of Student Media at Marquette University. He's with us today to look at the impact that declining social media traffic is having on news outlets and the way we get our news. You can let us know how you get news online on your phone or other device at 800-642-1234. Is social media a source of links to news items for you? The younger generation, according to some stats, TikTok, a rising force in how you connect to news. Is that you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jim is with us in Slinger. Jim, hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What's your news consumption habit, Jim?
My consumption habits are anything that has to do with Fox News or CNN or MSNBC. I generally just have a question and I'll go on to Google or DuckDuckGo and I'll look for headlines that I see that the answers may lie in. Like maybe Al Jazeera, that's pretty unbiased in my opinion. I found myself looking a lot now on Twitter. I find a wide variety, or X. I found a lot of wide variety of opinions and just comments. The comments are the most useful to me. I hate the opinions that usually come from a writer. The bias out there is terrible. Liberal bias is out of control and it's obvious. And I just don't go for it. I'll never click on a link. I'll never even give them a click, knowing, you know, what news organization is. I just won't do it. If it's a liberal bias, I'm not buying it.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Patrick is seeking out news from a variety of sources, but he's skeptical about some of the headlines he'll come across.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty common. I mean, I think one, that's a prime example of like how people can be news literate. being able to understand the difference between a news piece and an opinion piece. And I think in agreeance with Jim, there's a lot that's out there that isn't news, that is opinion. And we have to be able to help one another learn the difference between the two. I think it's also important to make sure that we are recognizing that a lot of these, the combinations of places like Google, DuckDuckGo, X, Facebook, et cetera, all have algorithms that are reading all of the other data that we have on our phones and our computers. And so the more we spend on certain sites that aren't even news sites, the more those things are being filtered through these algorithms, which are then spitting out this content to us. And so that also changes our news consumption habits, because those algorithms, especially through social media platforms, are giving people the news that they think, or that the algorithm thinks, they are more likely to believe. And I think that's also a part of what we need to be better at thinking about, that these algorithms are far more dangerous, I think, than sometimes we give them credit.
Jim, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Patrick, you said earlier you're optimistic that there can be models for news production. Let's talk first of all about what we might think about, maybe a mid-sized newspaper in a mid-sized city. It has a website too, of course. Do you see a model by which they can start to build that audience and do what we used to expect as a watchdog from that newspaper?
Yeah, I think when we talk about new models of journalism or where journalism can go, I think community engagement is one of the core tenets to that. One of the things that I think especially national journalism has kind of complicated for us is that because we've lost local papers, people only see perspectives from the national press, which oftentimes are complicated by people having the name, an analyst title versus a correspondent title versus an anchor title. And so when you look at a mid-sized newspaper, for example, like I'm down the street from the Journal Sentinel, the more we're able to get newspapers and the journalists back within our communities, generating these opportunities for trust building to exist, whether that means hosting town halls or the journalist one day a week sitting in a coffee shop and having essentially like office hours where community members can come sit and have conversations about what they want to see and read in their publication, but also what are they critical of? What, you know, if people are upset about liberal bias and opinion pieces, publications need to be more willing to hear that and to understand where that's coming from and what does that mean? And what does that mean for a subscriber? Are people not subscribing because of that? Well, research says, yeah, they're not. They're turning away from our publications. So to me, a new model has community engagement as the core, with transparency and care closely tied to them.
Let's go back to our callers. Kimani is with us in the Green Bay area. Kimani, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I think it's two-pronged. I guess the first part of my comment is why I think there have been less links on social media. I think the first one that's kind of obvious is that for a while there were a series of bots that were doing the work. But the second cultural piece of that is after what we had experienced with the 2016, with the elections in 2016 and 2020, I think we lost a lot of friends on social media. So now the social media posts are more back about the family and just the positive things that are going on in our lives. And then the second part of the comment is where we get our news from. My wife and I, we use, if we want news, we will go to either France 24, BBC, and crazily, Al Jazeera. I'm actually surprised at how straightforward Al Jazeera was. But so those are my comments.
Hey, Kimani, before I let you go, though, like if you want to read the BBC, you just go to, BBC.com or whatever. You don't search and maybe come across articles. You start with the news platform itself.
Well, I was just talking about where we get our video news from,
gotcha.
Like what we stream now. But as for what I read, I use an app called Flipboard, And in that app, it's got a really cool user interface where I put what, you know, my interests are, and it turns it into a magazine daily. And,
gotcha.
So Kimani, that's where I read. So
thanks a lot for sharing that. Patrick, that brings up something that disappeared that I thought was kind of cool for a while, RSS feeds online, where you could set up that subscription, basically, where you see stuff popping up on different websites.
Yeah, I think we almost, I think, are going to see a return of that a little bit in newer models. And I think where we're going to see that is actually through newsletters, which is like another variation of RSS feeds in some respects. Because to me, those newsletters allow for a different kind of personality to exist, but it also allows for more strategic engagement, meaning people are actually getting to directly sign up for something and get a glimpse of the news that they feel they can use, which hopefully then builds them towards wanting to subscribe. But places like Flipboard, apps like Flipboard are a really great example of that. Apple News does similarly, where you're able to curate in different ways. But yeah, I think RSS feeds, I remember many of them. But I think newsletters are that new wave that might actually be really good opportunities for social engagement.
Kimani, thanks for the call. Kimani also mentioned seeing Facebook return to more, you know, what people you know are doing, which I think I've noticed too. That's all I ever wanted from Facebook, Patrick. Like, how did it rise to become for a while there such a key factor in spreading news?
Well, which answer do you really want out of that one? So I actually am no longer a Facebook user, but I do think one of the things that did occur, and Kimani points out the elections as being a core tenet of this, I think it's more 2020 even than 2016. 2016 certainly had plenty of commentary associated, but I think what we saw was this really interesting tribalism and this almost permission to be able to post things that were more hyper-political and less fact-checked. And so what we thought oftentimes was news sometimes really wasn't. It masqueraded as such. And so we did see a lot of mis and disinformation spread through Facebook in particular, which Meta acknowledges and has acknowledged in several congressional hearings that they amplified a lot of that mis and disinformation, especially around the campaigns of 2016 and 2020. Because it meant more user engagement, even if that engagement was detrimental. And it's true. I think it drastically impacted people's relationships with one another. And it did so in like real nasty ways. Mm-hmm. And I think people are ready to be like, wait, where's the sun again? Can we find something a little happier to attach to? A more uniqueness to one another, I think is definitely something that we're striving to come back to.
Just a minute or so left, Patrick. I asked you about a model for commercial outlets to kind of rebuild in this new, maybe post-social media linking to news era. How about nonprofit alternatives? There are a bunch of different examples out there. Any of them that strike you as particularly promising?
The 19th. And I think nonprofits are in many respects a significant part of the future of our industry. In part because they're able to target niche audiences, and they're cultivating content around certain ideologies and certain ideas that are really important. The other one I think everyone should check out, and I hope more cities take on this model, is Resolve Philly, which is a organization in Philadelphia that is really looking to reframe community-centered news. And so if any listeners listening, I think places like Milwaukee, for example, need their own version of Resolve Philly.
Patrick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yes, have a great day.
That's Patrick Johnson, assistant professor of journalism and director of student media at Marquette University. He's with us today to talk about the impact of declining social media traffic toward news outlets and how we get our news online and what the future might hold for journalism and people who read it. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to The Ideas Network.